Hey everyone, what's going on? Welcome to a brand new edition of the Sam Bissell Podcast on the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions. And right now I'm going to be bringing you the latest and greatest going on around the world of Hollywood. Happy Halloween to everyone that is going to be trick or treating tonight. Hope everyone has a safe time out there getting candy, enjoying costumes, and having a really good time on this October 31st. A lot of stuff that I want to talk about on the podcast today. I'm going to be talking about a brand new Fandango poll talking about the most anticipated films to come out for the rest of 2023, as after this October 31st, we get into the final 2 months of 2023, and there are still a lot of really good films to look out for, so we'll talk about what people are really interested in seeing from that Fandango survey. I'm also going to be getting into what my thoughts were on Loki Season 2 so far, now that 4 episodes are out, and we have 2 weeks remaining on the second season of the MCU show. I'm also going to be talking about some new release dates that have been changed up from both Paramount Pictures and Walt Disney Studios due to the SAG-AFTRA strike. Some of the brand new, most anticipated films coming in the next year have been affected and have brand new release dates. So we'll get into that and so much more on the podcast. But the first thing that I do want to talk about on here today is the unfortunate news that happened over this past weekend, and that was the breaking news that came out in regards to the loss of one of the beloved members of the Friends, and that, of course, is Matthew Perry, who died at the age of 54, being found in his jacuzzi, according to the reports. And it's a very, very sad time. I know a lot of people, friends of mine included, family members, who are big fans of the Friends TV show. And of course, his role as Chandler Bing is very iconic alongside the likes of Jennifer Aniston, Courtney Cox, David Schwimmer, Lisa Kudrow. And what's very interesting to me about Matthew Perry is before even Friends, the first thing that I remember ever seeing him in was actually the last film that he ever did back in 2009 when he did the Zac Efron film 17 again, and he played an older version of that character that gets sucked back into time and he's transformed as a teenager who is played by Zac Efron. And that was my first introduction to Matthew Perry. And then, of course, I knew him through what he did in Friends, but also what really is iconic for me with Matthew Perry as well is what he's just done in recent years, coming out with his memoir last year, coming out with the Diane Sawyer interview, talking about his struggles with addiction, specifically when it comes to drugs and alcohol, and him talking about helping people through what he experienced and making sure that he was somebody who could be there for people that are struggling just like him and what he went through, and helping them see that light that he was able to see and stay sober and try to live life as best as they possibly could. And I think that's what makes this really tragic, is that he was really starting to come out with a lot of this stuff and it's just fresh in a lot of people's minds. And so to hear him and the fact that he died at the age of 54 and had still so much to live for, so much to do, there were reports already out there that he was getting ready to do another project, another movie, he had some TV shows that were coming out that he was creating. So he definitely had a lot of stuff on his plate, but the stuff that he'll be remembered for, both on and off the screen, is iconic in and of itself and will be remembered forever and ever. And so on behalf of the Sam Bissell Podcast and the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions, our thoughts and prayers are with the friends and family of Matthew Perry, who died way too suddenly at the age of 54. Now to move on to some other movie and TV news that is going on around the world of Hollywood right now. And the first thing that I want to start off with and continue with is the box office recap. Is when I do have a show and I do start out on the week, I really like to kind of talk about the weekend before and recap the big winners and losers for the past weekend at the box office. And this was probably one of the biggest box office surprises of the year so far. And it came on Halloween weekend, and a lot of it was led, of course, by the brand new Universal Blumhouse film Five Nights at Freddy's, which is now the number one new champion at the box office, and it outperformed huge expectations, or really kind of low expectations rather, and reaped high-end rewards for this film. And Five Nights at Freddy's was initially came in with the expectations and the projections of coming in at around $50 million. And this film, coming in at number one, out exceeded those expectations and came in at around $80 million this weekend. And it was initially $3 million lower than what the Monday estimates came out with. But because of the actuals that came out yesterday, instead of being around $78, $77 million, it actually bumped up $2 to $3 million to get at around $80 million for Five Nights at Freddy's. And if you'll have to excuse me for a sec, because I'm about to go down the list of records that this film has broke. This unexpected record breaker for Blumhouse did impressive numbers. So these are some of the stats that now are beholden to Five Nights at Freddy's. And so this film now has the highest opening for a horror film this year, beating March's Scream 6, which made $44.4 million. It is the second highest opening for a video game movie ever, behind, of course, the Super Mario Brothers movie, which outdid huge expectations and was at one point the highest grossing film of this year before Barbie overtook it in July. It is also the biggest opening for Blumhouse Pictures ever, going ahead of 2018's Halloween film, which of course was a sequel slash kind of semi reboot of the Halloween franchise, coming in, which that film did around $76.2 million, which was very impressive when it came out that year. It is also the 19th time a Blumhouse film has bowed at the number one spot and also helped bring the genre of horror's domestic box office to more than $3 billion for Blumhouse Pictures overall. And also at $130.6 million worldwide, this film is now the biggest horror worldwide bow year to date, ahead of this year's The Nun 2, which came in at $88.1 million back in September. It is also the biggest Blumhouse global debut of all time, ahead of that 2018 Halloween film, which came in at $91.8 million. It is also the biggest, just in general, Halloween weekend opener ever. The film that was number one before this film came out was Puss in Boots, all the way back in the early 2010s, which did only $34 million at the box office. It is also the second biggest opening ever for a film, debuting both in theaters and on a streaming service at the same time, which is really, really big, because this followed what Halloween Kills and Halloween's Ends did 2 years prior to it, and coming out both day and date release in theaters and on Peacock. And speaking of, it is also the best for a Peacock day and date release, beating Halloween Kills, which at that point was the highest grossing day and date release for Universal for Peacock, which made $49.4 million. In terms of just the overall generic day and date release, which because of the pandemic has become a really big thing, and especially in 2020, 2021, a lot of these studios were playing around with it. In terms of the records that those films had set over the last couple years, Five Nights at Freddy's now has tied with Black Widow, which made $80 million with that day and date release, for the best opening for that theatrical film while also being available on a streaming service. And if that wasn't enough, Five Nights at Freddy's now holds the fifth biggest opening in the month of November. The only four films ahead of it is the first Venom film, which came out in 2018 with $80.2 million. Then in 2021, it was Venom Let There Be Carnage, which made $90 million. Then at number two is this year's October film, which came out in the middle of the month with Taylor Swift's The Eras Tour, which made $92.8 million and was the highest grossing concert film of all time in just one weekend, and still the reigning defending champion in the month of October in terms of the biggest opening weekends in this month is still 2019's Joker, which made $96.2 million at the box office. But still, an impressive feat nonetheless for what this film was able to do. And one other record that I do want to mention, which to me is very, it stands out a lot for me, is that it is the biggest opening weekend for a horror film directed by a woman, ahead of Candyman, which did $22 million back in 2021 and was directed by also a filmmaker who has a new movie coming out in a couple weeks, in Nia DaCosta. So again, for this movie, it is incredibly impressive what this movie has been able to do. And I think there's a lot of stuff to take from this film and what it was able to do and how you might be able to replicate this kind of success moving forward. Now, sometimes you don't want to be able to replicate that. Sometimes you just want a film to do what it does. But you know these studios are going to find ways to make sure that these films continue to make money and they make a franchise and continue to do this stuff in the near future. But to me, what's really interesting about this film, and especially with Blumhouse, is A, Blumhouse is once again able to create nothing out of something. This was a film that had a $20 million budget. People who I've talked to really had no idea what this movie was, what it was based on. They only heard that it was based on a video game literally as it was coming out this past weekend. So this was really a film that I think speaks to a younger audience. I think it was smart for both Universal and Blumhouse to put this in theaters as a PG-13 film because I think you have bigger access to a younger audience that is in their teenage years. And I think it also helps that I think people are looking for something to see that is horror-based around this time period. Since it is Halloween, people want to be scared. And there have been offerings this month. You had The Exorcist Believer, which, again, wasn't that huge of an opening for Blumhouse. But, again, the great thing about that company is they might not do well on one film, but then they have another one that comes out a few weeks, a few months later, and that somehow overexceeds expectations and does the numbers that Five Nights at Freddy does. And they're able and they're able to do that basically, and they're able to see what these what this company and this film is able to do. And I think expanding out to the teenage demographic, I think making sure that this was PG-13 really helped this as well. Putting it within the time frame of October really helped it as well. And so I think all this was just a great, just stirring pot of a perfect storm that really helped this film. And I think that the way that they were able to market this film, especially given the SAG-AFTRA strike right now, not that, all due respect to someone like Josh Hutcherson, isn't really the biggest name in the world. I don't think he's a butts in seats kind of actor that can get people to go to the theaters. But I think not having that and relying on the actual characters of Five Nights at Freddy's, relying on the director to go out there and do promo, Jason Blum doing promo for this film, I think really was beneficial for this movie. And they were able to make something work with this. And again, it's the extraordinary thing about Blumhouse is risky, little risk, high reward for what they're able to do. And again, with the budgets that they're able to do sometimes, it's just incredible. And I remember, I always talk about it, but back in 2020, before the pandemic, when they did The Invisible Man, very short, very small budget, around, I think it was, might have been single digits, high teens, if anything, but it was able to make a huge amount of money before the pandemic really hit. It was a big success for them in the early parts of 2020. And for them right now, for this film, I think it is huge for the studio, but I also think it is huge for movie theaters as well. And I think this month alone has helped theaters sustain itself after the kind of dead month of September and coming off of the huge summer that it had, especially in the back half with Barbenheimer. October has really helped sustain theaters throughout this month, and I think will help throughout the next couple of months as well, given the SAG-AFTRA strike and given that films are pushing back a little bit to other release dates so that their actors can do press for their movies once that deal is done with the AMPTP and SAG-AFTRA. And so I think between the Taylor Swift film and this movie has really been a big plus for movie theaters. And I think in November, December, it's going to be very interesting to see where these films can go with the success of these movies. But I think because this film fits within that horror genre and you're able to get a younger demographic, I think this is another case of catering to that audience. I think the biggest audience that is going to movie theaters right now are younger audiences. It's not the middle-aged, older audiences that are going out right now. The ones that are consistently going every single weekend for the most part is the younger audience. And so I think even though a horror film usually is rated R, I think again it was smart for them to go the PG-13 route, widen the demographic, and I think that is usually what caters to horror fans. And I think what they're seeing right now with these numbers is incredible. And when you look at the overall numbers this film is doing, again, $80 million domestically, $52 million internationally, worldwide total already of $132 million overall. This film could stop going in theaters right now and it would already make back its budget and then some, and be warranted to make a sequel or two, really, if they wanted to, based on the budget that it had before marketing and advertising came into effect. And again, I think another part of this as well is the fact that it did come out on day and date. And from the reports that I've been seeing, even if it didn't come out day and date, it only really maybe lost $5 to $10 million on its own. So whether Halloween Kills, Halloween Ends last year, which did the day and date release, might have lost a little bit more money than what they could have gotten on opening weekend and in subsequent weeks when those respective films came out. So far, Five Nights at Freddy's seems to be a film that people want to go see in theaters. And if they don't, they can always go back and check it out on Peacock. And now the numbers on Peacock, we don't know what exactly they are. And I don't really trust what Universal is putting out for those numbers right now. But overall, I think this film is a smashing home run success for Blumhouse, for Universal. And what's so crazy is the fact that a film like Exorcist Believer comes out, doesn't do well for the company, is a little bit of a misfire given the fact that they spent $400 million plus on the rights to that franchise. What's Blumhouse going to do? And then all of a sudden, Five Nights at Freddy's comes out and they're able to recuperate some more of that money into this film. And they go from having a loser film, really, to a big-time winner with this one. So I'm really excited to see where this film goes from here. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see what the drop-off for this is going to be, because one of the things about horror films is that they have big opening weekends, but sometimes the drop-off can be exponential going into weekend two, weekend three. So for me, what's going to be interesting to see is where this film is going to go from here, because after today, November kicks in and spooky season is kind of over with. And so are people still going to have that same mindset, enthusiasm to go and see a scary movie in theaters this upcoming weekend? And this weekend is going to be very interesting because there's no big film coming out. The film that was supposed to come out this weekend in Doom Part 2 moved to March of next year. So how is this film going to do now that there's no really kind of major release coming out this year or this next weekend, and the next big time release isn't until 2 weekends from now when we get the new MCU film in the Marvels on November 10th. So this weekend is going to be very interesting to see where the drop off could be. Is it going to be because people might not be in the spooky season mindset? Could it be that maybe now more people are going to see this film on Peacock more so than in theaters? I think all these factors are going to be very, very interesting to see where Five Nights at Freddy's goes. But overall, when you're just coming off of this weekend, just in general, from that $130 million worldwide debut to the $80 million made domestically to the $50 million made internationally, again, it could close up shop right now and just debut on Peacock for the remainder of its future in the film, and it would still be a huge time winner no matter what. So congratulations to Blumhouse, Universal, the cast and crew, and everyone else that was involved in the making and marketing of this film. It was a huge success. It outperformed everybody's expectations, including my own, and did smashing numbers, breaking a whole lot of Halloween and October records for this film. So what did you guys think about what Five Nights at Freddy's did? Because I think it's a very, very impressive what it was able to do in taking the top spot at the box office this weekend. Then to continue on to the remainder of the top 10, coming in at number 2 was the reigning defending champion at the box office the last couple weekends, which was Taylor Swift, The Eras Tour. It is still doing very, very well at the box office. It made $15.4 million this past weekend. It has now made $150 million domestically, $53 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $203 million at the box office. And I haven't really been on here to kind of talk about the Eras Tour in these last couple of weeks of what the film has been able to do in theaters at the box office. But before Five Nights at Freddy's, this film was the heartbeat for the movie going experience the last couple of weeks after kind of being dead for well over a month. And I think even though it fell off at number 2, fell 53% from last weekend, it's still doing incredible numbers. It's still rewriting the books for what we think about in terms of concert film records at the box office. It's delivered on being an experience for young girls, teenage girls, adult women, everyone who is a fan of Taylor Swift and more, who wants to see this film, that either A, didn't get to see the Eras Tour live, B, saw the Eras Tour live but wanted to see this film, or B, just huge Taylor Swift fans and wanted to support, have gone to see this film. And even though it didn't have a huge, well, it had a huge opening weekend given it's a concert film, but given what the projections were, didn't hit those marks, but is still crushing at the box office right now. And again, like I said with Five Nights at Freddy's, that film is great for the movie-going expedition, but this film, I think, is key for movie theaters sustaining themselves right now, given the market and climate that it's in right now, and that a lot of the box office receipts, the dollar gross, is going to movie theaters, period, and not going to any studios at all. The only other place that it's going to is in the pockets of Taylor Swift and her company, who produced this film and made it an exclusive deal with movie theaters, overgoing and overlooking the studios to go right to the source for people that will go see these movies. So Taylor Swift, the Eras Tour, killing it on the movie front right now. Then coming in at number three this weekend, after being number two last weekend, is the brand new Marty Scorsese film, Killers of the Flower Moon, which did $9.3 million at the box office. It's now made $40 million domestically, $44 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $86 million at the box office. Now, the thing that's interesting to me with Killers of the Flower Moon was I was never expecting, I don't think a lot of people were expecting this film to be a huge smashing success. And the thing with Martin Scorsese films is, even though he is one of the greatest directors, filmmakers of all time, period, bar none, is his films don't do James Cameron, Steven Spielberg kind of numbers at the box office. They usually become hits and classics through just word of mouth, watching, rewatching, whether it's in theaters, at home, on TV. That's usually how it rolls with a Martin Scorsese film. For the most part, there's been some exceptions here and there, but usually with his movies, they don't always just top off during the box office, especially during opening weekend. And the thing that's interesting about this is last weekend, Killers of the Flower Moon was the second highest grossing opening weekend for Martin Scorsese. The only one that was ahead of it was Shutter Island from years ago. And again, it just showcases that these kinds of films, for people, they're interested in going to see it, but I think the thing about this is that people are more looking to watch it at home than going to the theaters, especially given its 3.5-hour runtime, which, if you want to check out my review of Killers of the Flower Moon, it's on my podcast as well. I do detail how you really feel the 3.5 hours of this movie. And so I think people are going to be looking for this film to watch on Apple TV Plus. I think they're going to wait for this film to come to their homes and not go to the theaters. Even though it does have the likes of Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro in the cast, I don't think it's going to be a film that everyone's flocking to go see. I know people that are excited to watch this movie, but they might wait to watch it at home before going to the theaters to see it. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see where this film can go with its box office, because I do think that with Killers of the Flower Moon, it's going to be very interesting, because I don't know, it might be able to break even because it has a $200 million budget before marketing. And the thing with this is that you didn't really have to pay a whole lot for the marketing, because you didn't have your actors to really kind of pay to do marketing because of the SAG-AFTRA strike for the most part. So I don't think the P&A budget for this one is as big as I think a lot of people are expecting, but the budget of this film overall was still a little over $200 million to spend on, and so it's going to have to be able to break even, and I think it might, but I think it's going to be, I think for Apple, the big test is going to be playing it in theaters, get that buzz going, and then when they debut it on Apple TV Plus, what do those numbers look like? And so maybe the subscribers numbers for Apple is what drives and compensates for that $200 million. That they'd spend on this movie. So I think that's going to be the very interesting thing to see. I think that's the strategy that Apple is going with right now, moving forward with putting their films in theaters before putting it on their streaming service. They did it with this. They're doing it for Napoleon in the next month with the film from Ridley Scott and Joaquin Phoenix. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this film does, because with Apple, they can put $200 million into this movie, and that's just really kind of chump change for a $1 billion tech company. And I think for them, this is just really kind of an experiment and wait and see approach. And even if they lose money on this, I think they'll be ready to do that more and more and more if it gets them to do projects like this with high prestigious people like a Martin Scorsese, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Robert De Niro, alongside someone like a Lily Gladstone, and tell these kinds of stories as well. So I think this is a film to keep an eye on how the box office performance goes. I don't think we can write it off just yet and see where it progresses in the next couple of weeks, especially heading into award season. And the fact that I think this film is very much going to be in the heart of the Oscars this year with nominations, potential wins, I think this is one to keep an eye on to see how it does in theaters and also how it does on Apple TV Plus. The next film to come in at number four at this weekend's box office was the film After Death, which did $5 million at the box office. It has also made an international gross, which it hasn't made an international gross, so its worldwide total is still the total that it's made domestically, which was $5 million. Then coming on in the number five spot is the other Blumhouse film from Universal as well, in The Exorcist Believer, which did $3.2 million at the box office. It's now made $59 million domestically. Internationally, it has tallied up $61 million in total for a worldwide total of $120 million at the box office. Then coming in at number six this past weekend was Paw Patrol: The Mighty Movie, which did an additional $2.3 million at the box office. It's now made $59.3 million domestically. Internationally, it's made $107 million for a worldwide total tally of $166 million at the box office. Then coming in at number seven is the 30th anniversary re-release of the Tim Burton film The Nightmare Before Christmas, of course, coming out during the Halloween season right at the tail end of it. It did $2.1 million at the box office. It's now made in its entire total run $8.2 million, which worldwide it's also done that as well. Then to round out the top 10 with the last three spots, coming at number eight was Freelance, which did $2 million at the box office. It has not, it has come out in international markets, but it's only made $596,000 at the box office. So its worldwide total is only at $2.68 million at the box office. And that is a film that stars Alison Brie and John Cena. Then coming in at number nine is the latest installment in the Saw franchise in Saw 10. It's gross an additional $1.7 million at the box office. It's now made $50.3 million domestically, $32 million internationally for a worldwide total of $83.5 million at the box office. And then rounding out the top 10 this weekend, coming in the 10 spot is the Gareth Edwards film, The Creator, which made an additional $1.0 million in the box office. It's now made $38.8 million domestically. Internationally, it's made $58.7 million, and worldwide, it's made $97.7 million at the box office. So that is your top 10 for this past weekend. Again, going from 10 to 1, number 10 was The Creator, number 9 was Saw 10 or Saw X, number 8 was Freelance, number 7 was the 30th anniversary re-release of The Nightmare Before Christmas, number 6 is Paw Patrol: The Mighty Movie, number 5 was The Exorcist Believer, number 4 was After Death, number 3 was Killers of the Flower Moon, number 2 was Taylor Swift: The Eras Tour, and then coming in as the new number 1 champion at the box office this weekend is the record breaker from Universal Pictures and Blumhouse, Five Nights at Freddy's. So that is your box office from this past weekend. What did you guys think about the box office? What were your thoughts, reactions to the results of this past weekend? Let me know down below in the comment section and leave your thoughts. Now to move on from the box office to the TV review corner of the Sam Bassell podcast, there's been a little show that I've been watching over the last couple of weeks, and it's four episodes in, and is the latest from the Marvel Cinematic Universe side of the TV world, and that is the second season of their hit show, Loki. And this is a show that, of course, stars Tom Hiddleston as the God of Mischief. Owen Wilson is back as Momin Morbius. You also have Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Wumi Mousaka. You have a litany of people. Kiwi Kwan is in this as well, coming off of his Academy Award win early this year for Everything Everywhere All at Once. And so I've been really excited about this second season. I was a huge fan of season one, and it seems like this show is very critical for what is going to be happening within this new saga that the MCU is telling with the multiverse. And given the fact that some of the TV offerings, especially coming off of this summer's Secret Invasion, have been very underwhelming to say the least, I was kind of hoping for this one to be a little bit of a pick-me-up and get me back to what I think is greatness and what started off with greatness within the TV corner of the MCU, coming off of the likes of WandaVision, Falcon the Winter Soldier, Loki, Hawkeye. I thought that first litany of TV shows was huge and great television from the MCU, and so I was really hoping for this to get it back on track, and thank God it has been able to do that and more. I think the second season of Loki has been awesome so far. I think it's done a great job of just keeping with what worked in season one and expanding on it in season two, and not just telling a new story, but continuing the cliffhangers and story threads that were left off from season one. And it seems like they were really going somewhere with this in season two, while also, again, introducing new elements and questions and modes about time travel and the space-time continuum and the multiverse. And it doesn't feel like it's getting confusing whatsoever, to me at least. Maybe for some people it might be getting a little confusing, but I think they've done a great job in keeping it as simplistic as possible, because elements like this, when you're dealing with multiverses, timelines, time travel, all this stuff, can get very muddling and confusing. And that was one of the things that really worried me about Loki season one, when we're introducing all these new elements within the MCU after kind of being on a main stretch path for a long period of time. But I think what has been very good is that, again, it's simplifying everything and making it easier for audiences, whether it's hardcore MCU fans or just casual audience members, and make it digestible for us to view this stuff and make sense of what they're trying to tell us with this story. I think when we look at cast members, Tom Hiddleston once again crushes it. I think he's giving us somehow, some way, after playing this character for so many years, you wonder what the hell can this guy do as Loki that is just different and new and still make it fresh? Like, how can you do that after so many iterations, appearances as this character since 2011, and yet somehow, some way, he brings new layers, new dynamics to this character that, to me, make it the best iteration of Loki that we have gotten. He's somebody that I think finally has a purpose for what he wants to do, at least this version of Loki. He's found his kind of home with the TVA, and he's doing everything he possibly can to save it. And I think seeing the relationship between him and Mobius, who's played by Owen Wilson, so well, their dynamic continues to be incredible. I think the brand new addition of Ki-Wei Kwan is just so good. And after seeing his performance in Everything Everywhere All at Once, for him to land in the MCU in this way, I think is perfect and continues the kind of themes and style and just kind of flavor that translates very well from Everything Everywhere to Loki. If there was somewhere for him to fit in the MCU, it's in this corner that Loki is trying to present with itself right now. So every single time this man is on screen as the new character named Obi, he just steals the show and he is awesome. And I want to see more of him in this final season, especially coming up with the final two episodes. I think Natalie Holt's score, it's still one of my favorites of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, period. And it continues without this within this season so far. And there's one episode, not to give anything away, it was episode 4, this past episode from last week, that there's one of the things that I love about the show is the quirky sci-fi aspect to it, and you can hear it within the strings and tone of the show, and it plays through the score. And there's the ending song that plays in episode 4 is very ominous and mysterious and terrifying, and that's really kind of been the theme that I felt without Loki so far throughout its two seasons, and a lot of that has to do with the score. So for me, Natalie Holt just continues to do an incredible job without giving anything away. The cliffhanger is legitimate, everyone. Believe the hype of the cliffhanger at episode 4. I really don't have any idea where they're going with the final two episodes, but I'm very excited to see what they do. And I think this show really has brought Marvel back, at least in some good graces, within the TV world. I still think with their movies, it's 50-50 at this point. But I think after Secret Invasion, some of their other shows, it was a little bit lacking, for a better term. And I think Loki season 2 has gotten it back to a very respectable place right now. But I've always said this about Marvel shows, and it's also the same sometimes with Star Wars as well. To me, they always do a very good job at the beginning. It feels a little bit, I don't know what you're doing in the middle, and then it really flatlines by the end. So far, beginning has been awesome. Middle has been insanely good. So I'm hoping with these final two episodes, however they pack them in, that they really deliver a great killer blow and really wrap things up, whether they dangle it for a season three or for future things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe with these characters moving forward, or they want to wrap this up within this season. Whatever they do, I hope it is a very good ending that feels like, okay, I went through a journey and I feel like I came out with in a different way at the end of the season, which I haven't felt, especially with the MCU, I haven't felt that with a lot of shows in recent memory. So I'm hoping for good things with Loki Season 2, and so far it's been very, very good to me, and I'm hoping that we get more of that moving forward with this show, even though we only have 2 weeks left with this movie. So what do you guys think about Season 2 of Loki so far? Have you enjoyed it? Have you not enjoyed it? Has it lived up to your expectations? Has it not? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And the next thing that I want to move on to is out of the TV corner and into some movie news that I want to talk about on the podcast as I start to wrap things up. And one of the big things that came out of the past week was the kind of inevitability that seems to be happening with the SAG-AFTRA strike right now. And again, as of this recording, right now, as this podcast is posted, the SAG-AFTRA strike is still ongoing. There has not been a deal reached by both the AMPTP and the SAG-AFTRA union. They are still in talks as of this moment right now. If any updates come out, I will post an updated podcast about it. But so far, the SAG-AFTRA strike is still ongoing. And basically, even though the writer's strike is over with, the SAG-AFTRA strike is still a big proponent in getting Hollywood back up and running to its fullest capacity. Because as of right now, all productions are shut down right now because you need actors to be in front of the cameras to shoot things and say lines and dialogue and action and all that stuff. And in order to promote films, you need actors to be there to promote their movie. So that's why you have films like Dune Part 2 moving off of November to March, because a film like that, a big film that has A-listers on board, you want to promote that. There's a reason you get that, and it's not just because of the talent, which all those actors do. It's because they're good on the eyes, and people want to see these people on the red carpets. They want to see pictures and videos. They want all that stuff. And so that is a huge, huge, huge proponent of marketing and getting a movie out there and making it a big success. But the biggest thing, of course, is making sure that you can green light and get things back up and running on productions to make sure they hit these dates. And one of the things that was inevitable, really, was some of these films being delayed. Basically, not that it's another version of COVID, but we're basically in the same musical chairs of release date changes that COVID kind of brought back in 2020 and 2021, where we didn't know where everything was kind of standing, but we knew inevitably these films were probably going to be pushed back more and more and more. And that is what is happening right now with some of these films. And it's not just affecting 2023, it's affecting the overall calendar, movie calendar of 2024. And some big time films from Paramount Pictures and Disney are moving off of their respective spots. And so to go to Paramount first, because they were the first ones to announce these release changes for some of their films, one of the big ones, or probably their biggest one coming out next year, of course, is the next installment and the Mission Impossible franchise, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 2, or at least that is what the ongoing title is going to be. According to some reports, the film could be getting a reworked title as well, but along with the potential reworked title, it is going to be delayed from June 28, 2024, a full year later, basically, to Memorial Day weekend of 2025. And in its place on June 28, 2024, now that MI8 is off that date, A Quiet Place Day One, which is going to be the first spinoff from the Quiet Place franchise that was created by John Krasinski, will be moving from March 8th, 2024 to June 28th, 2024. And it will be having access to IMAX screens on June 28th. On March 8th, it was in cahoots with Kung Fu Panda 3. And the film that was going to be coming out a week later is Dune Part 2 on March 15th. So Quiet Place Day One is able to move off of those dates and get a nice little cushion for June 28th, and we'll probably be able to profit potentially very well from that spot as well, especially being a big horror name and franchise right in the heart of the summer movie season next year. But that is the big one for MI8 being the film that is delayed. So I'll get into that one real quick and kind of break it all down. But then to go to Disney real quick, there were some big changes for next year that are going to be very effective for the theatrical release window. And the big ones for that is that the live action version of Snow White, which is going to star Rachel Zegler and Gal Gadot, is moving a full year from March 22nd, 2024 to March 21st of 2025. And then one of Pixar's, of what would have been two films next year, the first, the earlier film that was supposed to come out for Pixar next year in 2024, Elio, is moving from March 1st, 2024 to the summer movie season of 2025, specifically June 13th of that year. So now that Elio is moving away from 2024, only one Pixar film is coming out next year, and that will be Inside Out 2, set for June 14th of next year. And then another film, and this one is kind of not predicated on the strike, but more so predicated with its, with the star that is attached to this and the legal drama that they are involved with right now. Magazine Dreams, which stars Jonathan Majors, is now officially off of Disney's 2023 movie calendar, which is huge because, again, this is a film that Disney and Fox, 20th Century Studios, really kind of picked up in the Sundance Film Festival earlier in the year when this film was earning really, really good reviews. It could have potentially gotten Jonathan Majors a potential Oscar nomination and so on and so forth. But because of the legal amalgamations of Jonathan Majors right now, that is not the case. And it makes sense that Disney probably wouldn't want to put this film out there right now when Jonathan Majors has some personal stuff that he is dealing with on the legal front at this given moment and time. But to kind of break down everything else that is going on with these release dates, even though, to go to Paramount first again with Mission Impossible 8, now that that's what I'm going to call it, now that it seems like the title is going to get reworked, I think even though that it's going to be delayed a full year, I think in the long run, I think that is actually better served for the film. Because I think when you look at Mission Impossible 7 this year, the thing that really hampered it, And nobody saw this coming, and I think Tom Cruise saw the writings on the walls before any of us did, which is why it was in reports. The reason I think Mission Impossible 7 wasn't as successful as some of the other movies is, A, I think it was because of its release date. I thought July would have been a great month. Mission Impossible did really well in July, but it didn't do well during that stretch of time. It didn't do what a lot of people thought it was going to do, and I think it was because of the month of July. And I think it was because of the phenomenon of Barbenheimer, this film wasn't able to have access to IMAX screens for a good chunk of time. A lot of it went to Oppenheimer when Nolan's latest film came out just 2 weeks later in the middle of July. And so Mission Impossible 7 lost all of those IMAX screens for the most part. Then they all went to Nolan's new movie. So those things were really kind of working against this film. And I also think, to go to the title real quick, not having a part one involved, I think maybe turned a lot of people off saying, well, this is only part one of a story. Why do I want to see half a story when I can just wait for this to come online and maybe go see the other part in theaters next year? And so I think that's why they're going to be reworking the title, so they don't have that happen. And people can just maybe go and be like, oh, a new Mission Impossible film, let me go see it. And it gives a 2 year window again for them to film what they need to film, because that's another part of this. The reason they pushed it is because of the SAG-AFTRA strike. They can't work, and they were really supposed to be working until the rest of this year to finish the eighth film. And so they still have to finish that, and it was going to take them, it sounded like, 3 to 4 months to really wrap it up. And so once the strike ends, whether it's in the next couple days, next couple weeks, they need a couple more months to really finish up and wrap what they need to do, and then go into post-production and work everything out that they need to. And so it all makes sense for them, I think, to really push it to 2025. And I think for Memorial Day weekend, I think that is actually a smart way of going about it, because I think when you look at what Top Gun Maverick was able to do last year, that seems to be a great spot for Tom Cruise to debut his films. And I think you get the 4-day weekend, which Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 did not have this year, which I didn't get that because it came out in the middle of July, and like the second weekend of July, where there was really nothing coming out except for Insidious the Red Door in that first weekend of July, and that was right after July 4th weekend. I feel like it could have found its way in there, but it somehow didn't do that. So I think coming out on a holiday weekend works for Tom Cruise, and I think it'll work really well for Mission Impossible 8. And for a Quiet Place Day One, I think that is a huge boost of confidence that Paramount is giving this film, that they trust that even though this film won't star John Krasinski, it'll star a whole new host of people such as Lupita Nyong'o, Joseph Quinn from Stranger Things, that the name in and of itself in A Quiet Place is strong enough now after two successful films that this film will get people in theaters to see this during the summer movie season. And horror films can do really well. And this isn't a film that is going to cost $100, $150 million. I think it's going to be within double digits. And so if this film is as good as the other previous two Quiet Place films are, then I think this can do really, really well and be a big hit come the summer movie season of next year. So I like where those two films ended up. And then to go to the Disney side of things, for me, the Snow White one is a little bit interesting about why they move it a full year away. It sounds like they did principal photography, they did reshoot. So it's not like the SAG-AFTRA strike is hampering production work or post-production work or even reshoots. If anything, it would be hampering the promotional tour of this film, which even that kind of still is a little interesting, because even if the strike were to end in the next couple weeks, this film isn't coming out till March. So you would still have time to maybe rework a schedule, especially if Gal Gadot, Rachel Zegler have other stuff that had to get pushed back because of the strike, that maybe you had to work that out a little bit. But I still think you'd be able to have enough time to rework certain things out to make sure you still had a full promotional press tour for when Snow White comes out at the end of March. So to me, that's a little bit interesting. It also might be because of some of the bad publicity the film has gotten over the last couple of months with its star, that maybe they want to push it back a little bit to give it some more time. And that could be very well the case. But to me, this film just is trending to all roads of just trouble, that there's just nothing good that's going to come out of this. And the latest edition of that was this first look photo of the film that came out, where it shows Rachel Zegler as Snow White, and it shows for the first time what the Seven Dwarves are going to look like. And to me, Rachel Zegler looks great, and I've seen set photos of her in the costume. She's not the problem to me. I think she's going to do a marvelous job. She's a great actress, and even though she's had some things go on personally with all this controversy happening, I hope she's learned from some of it. I still think she can be a great actress. I loved her in West Side Story. I can't wait to see what she's going to do in The Ballads of Songbirds and Snakes. I thought Shazam was a little bit of a misstep. I didn't think they used her in the best way possible. I thought she tried her best, but it just, not a great script, not a great character. And so I'm hoping that's what that was. And then these next two installments can really, really boost at least herself the show, what I think is really could be one of the next great young actresses and be up there in the likes of a Jenna Ortega potentially. Unfortunately, it again, all roads are leading for this film to be bad. But to me, the thing that just really stood out that just looked so bad were the dwarves. The dwarves don't look real. And I know that they're fake and it's an imaginary world, but you want them to look somewhat legitimately real. And that could be, that's been another theory I've been hearing. That could be another thing as well, where maybe they wanted to showcase this picture and kind of do what they did with Sonic the Hedgehog back in 2020 a little bit, where they released that trailer. The look of Sonic looked horrible. They pushed the release date of that film, reworked the character on a CGI level, and he looked a lot better and more accurate to what he is in the video games than what they looked him to be initially. So maybe they want to put this picture out. Maybe they delayed it so that they can work on the VFX of this a little bit more, and hearing what the reception of it is, which I can tell you is not the best reception that I'm sure that they are getting for the look of the dwarves right now. So it just has not looked good for me so far, but I'm holding out hope because I want this for Rachel Zegler. I'm a huge fan of hers already. I saw the potential of her in West Side Story, and I think she could have a great career in this industry, and doing something like Snow White I think is a huge, huge opportunity. And I'm hoping this film is able to land. I like Mark Webb as a director. Greta Gerwig was one of the writers on this, and it was well before she did Barbie, but she is as big as anybody in the industry right now. And so whatever she pops up in or whatever credential she has her name on is going to be big. And so I think all this is, it's going to be very interesting. And so we'll see what they're going to do with the time that they have with this year. Maybe they're going to reshoot some things, maybe not. We'll see where it goes. But that one to me was a little interesting. Same thing with Elio. Because to me, maybe Elio needed a little bit more work on, but that's on the the VFX side a little bit. And I just think that this is one thing that is going to be very, very interesting to see as well, and to see where this thing goes moving forward. And I'm very interested in and curious to see where we move forward with this film as well. And especially given with what they're going to do, I think, with Inside Out 2, I'm very curious about that one. But unfortunately, these films are going to be delayed, and I wouldn't be shocked if we get a couple more films that are going to be delayed on other studio signs as well. So we'll see where this all goes, and we'll keep updating you on the podcast as we move along. So what do you guys think about these switch dates for Paramount Pictures and Disney as well? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts as well. And the final thing that I want to talk about on the podcast today is a very interesting Fandango survey that came out for the remaining films coming in 2023. So according to this Fandango survey right now, based off of 2,000 moviegoers that they surveyed, they found what people are looking forward to in their top 10 most anticipated films coming out for basically the remainder of 2023 for their holiday releases. So to go through the top 10 real quick of what people chose, I'll go from 10 to 1. Number 10, they have Godzilla Minus One. Number 9, they have the new Yorgos film Poor Things with Emma Stone. Number 8 is the Michael Mann film Ferrari. Number 7 is the newest adaptation for The Color Purple. Number 6 is the new Disney animated film Wish. Number 5 is the new Ridley Scott film Napoleon. Number 4 is The Hunger Games prequel, The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Number 3 is Wonka. Number 2 is the latest DC film in Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. And number 1, still to this day, the MCU reigns supreme for people that are interested in, that is, of course, The Marvel. So those are the top 10 films that people are excited to see. And nothing in, to me, particular stands out about this. If anything, I think it's the bottom half of that list that is very interesting. Ferrari, Poor Things, Godzilla Minus One are very, very interesting to me that people are looking forward to. I guess Godzilla, anything Godzilla people are going to be excited about. But to me, Poor Things is very interesting because Yorgos is somebody who is very much more of an independent filmmaker. I know The Favorite was a big film of his from a couple years ago. It was a huge Academy Award winner. Of course, pulling off that upset in Best Actress that went to Olivia Colman over Glenn Close. And then for me, Ferrari is one where I think Michael Mann is somebody who hasn't really been around for a little bit. And him teaming up with Adam Driver for a film like Ferrari is very interesting as well. But the rest of this list to me makes total sense. Again, number one, number two, superhero films, comic book films, I think still rank a lot in a lot of people's minds. Wonka to me, number three, is encouraging. I think that film is going to surprise a lot more people than I think people are expected for. I think it could do really, really well at the box office, especially if the SAG-AFTRA strike is able to end and Timothy is able to actually promote this movie. I think it could be a surprise hit for the holiday season and actually outperform the likes of maybe a film like Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom and some of these other films. Seeing The Hunger Games on there, I think, is really, really encouraging, given the fact that initial reports just came out, that it came out with around $50 million potentially to open during the weekend. And also, that even with the SAG-AFTRA strike going on right now, Lionsgate was able to come to an agreement with the union and able to do an interim agreement, so the cast is able to promote this film, so it'll be able to get everybody out there to promote this movie. And so I think that'll actually boost up the numbers potentially for this film in the next couple of weeks. So I really like this list, and I think it's encouraging. It's a variety of films that are coming out that are going to really end 2023 and hopefully end them on a really, really big high note. So what do you guys think about this list? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And with that down and out of the way, that will do it for this edition of the Sam Vassell Podcast. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to check out my channel for more content. You can check me out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, SoundCloud, and much more. Also, make sure to tune in on to the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions, and be sure to check out the other amazing shows that are on here, such as You Mad Bro, the number one source to see what the internet is pissed off about on a weekly basis. Also, check out Goal Driven Professionals, geared toward improving client relations, return on investment, and customer acquisition costs for independent businesses and services. Also, make sure to check out The Daily Grind, a weekly motivational podcast with Kelly Johnson, giving you everyday tips and key takeaways on reaching your goals. Also, make sure to check out these other amazing shows on the podcast solutions, such as Wrestle Addict Radio, Fritzlemania Podcast, and Midnight Showing. You can check these out and so much more more on the website, ambiguouspodcastsolutions.com. Also on Facebook and Twitter at Real Ambiguous. And if you want to check out Kennedy Treehouse, use the coupon code AMBIGUOUS. Also, when you get a chance, make sure to follow me on social media. You can find me on X at Basil Samuel. That's BUSSELLSAMUEL. And also on Facebook at Sam Basil. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, keep on screening.